I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. Things got testy yesterday between Senators Chuck Schumer and Chuck Grassley at a meeting of the Senate Judiciary Committee. They got into an argument over whether the opponents of the new immigration bill were using the Boston Marathon bombing as a delaying tactic. Here's some of what transpired. Senator Schumer speaks first.
The chairman has a very open process, so if you have ways to improve the bill, offer an amendment when we start markup in May and let's vote on it. I say that particularly those who are pointing to what happened, the terrible tragedy in Boston, as a excuse for not doing a bill or delaying it many months or years.
I never said that.
I didn't say you did.
I never said that.
I didn't say you did, sir.
I didn't say anything
I didn't say
about
you did. I don't
bill.
Mean you, Mr. Grassley.
Mr. Chairman, I don't appreciate the witnesses that have come here.
That was Senator Patrick Leahy gaveling the meeting to order. The so-called Gang of Eight, made up of four Republicans and four Democrats, introduced legislation last week that, if passed, would be the most consequential change to the country's immigration laws in a generation. We asked Alan Gomez to join us on Radio Times. He's immigration reporter for USA Today. And, Alan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great being here. Thanks.
You're welcome. Is that a pretty typical interchange at a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing?
That was definitely the most heated that it got. But it is, I mean, this is something that is incredibly emotional for so many sides. I mean, one witness yesterday started breaking down in tears when she was telling her story about growing up as an unauthorized immigrant here in this country. There was a lot of heated disagreements over so many provisions of this bill. So while that was the peak, I mean, that sentiment is always close to the surface.
And I don't want to get too much in the weeds here, but are critics, or have some senators, maybe even Senator Chuck Grassley, are they trying to delay this immigration bill? Is there any way to figure that out at this juncture?
Well, no, they're not shy about it. They definitely want to slow down on this. The Senate Gang of Eight, this bipartisan group of senators that pulled out this bill, they're going to have a couple of hearings on this that they've been having in the Senate Judiciary Committee, and they want to get it quickly to a vote, quickly to the Senate floor to get movement on this thing. And there are many senators, Ted Cruz, Chuck Grassley, Jeff Sessions from Alabama, who are pushing to slow it down to take some time to go through some of these provisions, because it's an 844-page bill, and it is loaded with all sorts of changes to every part of our immigration system. So they want to take it a little bit slower.
Have you read all those pages, Alan?
I'm almost there.
That's a lot of pages. Is that pretty typical for, and I realize immigration is a very complex, even loaded issue, but is that typical to have a bill of that length?
It's not that typical. I mean, when you start looking at things like the health care plan that President Obama got through a few years ago, those kind of bills that deal with such structural changes to government programs, yeah, they can run a little bit long, but this one's definitely on the long side.
When was the last time Congress took up the issue of immigration at this level?
And they've tried. Well, the last time we got one passed was in 1986, and that's when President Reagan signed into law the immigration law that allowed for up to 3 million unauthorized immigrants to get citizenship, and it promised to secure the border. It did not do that. Obviously, we've seen up to 11 million more unauthorized immigrants get into the country, so that part of that bill was kind of, you know, halfway functional. Ever since, there have been several attempts, as recently as 2010 and 2007. There was a big push to almost get this through with the late Senator Ted Kennedy making the push on that one. But this is, I think this is about as far as this one's got the best chance, I think, since we've seen in 1986.
Do you think the 2012 election changed the calculus, perhaps, on this issue?
There is no question about it. If you just have to look at the fact that Mitt Romney garnered 27% of the Hispanic vote in the election, and right after that, you heard members of this bipartisan group of senators, John McCain from Arizona, saying that they had to change their image with Hispanics, and this is a very fast-growing electorate. You know, maybe immigration isn't their top priority, but if you're talking so poorly on the issue of immigration, it makes it hard to connect with those voters. So that's why you're seeing a lot of these guys jump on board now.
And how long has the Gang of Eight, as they are called, how long have they been working on this bill?
They announced their their sort of general agreement, and they announced the fact that they were going to do this back in late January. So it took a couple of months. I mean, this is a very hard thing to put together. To give an example, there's a similar group in the House of Representatives that have been meeting for years to try to craft a bill that could make it through the House, and they still have not filed their bill. They're trying to get it out in the next couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. But that just shows you how difficult it is to deal with such a large issue, especially since there's so many competing sides on every single aspect of the bill. The Senate actually did, they got it in there pretty quick. But it took them a little while to get there.
And Senator Marco Rubio, I don't think it was this Sunday, I think it was the Sunday before, was perhaps on every one of those Sunday TV talk shows. Is he the front man for this bill?
Exactly. He was on seven talk shows that Sunday. And then a few days later, he was on just a bunch of conservative radio shows to keep pushing this. Yeah, he's sort of become the unofficial spokesman of this. John McCain, Chuck Schumer from New York, Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, they're all part of the group, but they've been parts of these groups for many years now. So what Rubio brings is, the fresh face. He's a very quickly up-and-coming member of the Republican Party. He's obviously always mentioned as a potential 2016 candidate. He's got great favorability with the Tea Party. They love him, and he happens to be Hispanic. So you kind of put that all together, and he's the perfect face to sell this. And he's been, his press shop is the one that's kind of pushing all this. He's on all the shows. He's on all the radio shows. And, they've kind of made him sort of the unofficial spokesman for this thing.
And I do want to talk to you about what's actually in the bill, but does it have support of labor unions and immigration advocates? I was even reading that La Raza, who had been, on the fence on some of these issues, seems to be behind this particular piece of legislation.
That's been the remarkable thing about this attempt. I mean, back the last time we got close in 2007, all those sides never really came to even a general agreement on some of these things. When the senators formally unveiled the bill during a press conference last week, they made a point to reserve a bigger room so that they could have all the different actors behind them. So you did have the AFL-CIO there. You had the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. These are two sides that are usually never in agreement. So having them back there was very significant. When you look at agricultural work, you had farm labor, the farm labor union standing side by side with farmers. This is the most support kind of across the board that one of these bills has gotten in a very long time. The question is whether they can hold on as this bill goes through what is going to be an incredibly difficult process through the Senate, then through the House. It's going to be really tough to keep everybody on board, and that's going to be the challenge.
And that's Alan Gomez, immigration reporter for USA Today. We are talking about the immigration bill introduced in the Senate last week. We're going to be breaking it down as well and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Alan, let's talk about border security, because as you mentioned, back in the 80s, that was part of the immigration bill signed by President Reagan, but didn't really go into effect. What is part of this bill related to border security?
Well, unquestionably, they are throwing a lot of resources at the border. The bill calls for $6.5 billion initially to go down to the southwest border with Mexico. We're talking 3,500 additional border patrol agents down there, more surveillance technology, the ability to authorize the National Guard to go down there and assist, and the creation of a lot more fencing along the border. So they're really throwing a lot down there. What troubles folks and people who've been kind of specifically Republicans who've been looking at the bill for the last few days now, it's become clear that there is nothing in the bill that says if we can't measure that the border is secure by any measure, that does not stop the process for unauthorized immigrants to become legal permanent residents and eventually U.S. citizens. That's been one of the big sticking points. Some folks want a certain metric to have to be reached, some way of verifying that the border is secure before these folks are able to become citizens. And so the compromise that they've reached in this bill is that they're throwing a lot of money down there, a lot of manpower, but there's no metric that kind of holds you back if for these folks to move on to citizenship.
But do they want 100% security that everyone trying to enter this country illegally is pushed back?
What they have is goals that they've put into the bill, and what they want is to be able to monitor 100% of the border and apprehend or stop at least 90% of people who are coming across in high-risk areas. And that means that's about as much as they think they can realistically achieve.
And where are those high-risk areas? I'm curious.
The way they define it is a Border Patrol sector that had more than 30,000 apprehensions, which means they stopped 30,000 people that were trying to illegally cross there. In 2012, that would have been three sectors. The Tucson sector in Arizona, which is the eastern half of the state, which is one of the biggest corridors for illegal immigration, for drug smuggling, for all of that. And then the two eastern sectors in Texas. So those would be where the bill would prioritize a lot of the, where they would focus on, at least in the first year, and that would change maybe as, you know, folks, as illegal immigrants sort of adjusted and moved to other sectors, but that would be the focus to start.
And would this be, is this a responsibility of the Department of Homeland Security? Do they oversee then this border issue?
They would, and what happens, yeah, it's one of these.
Sorry, Alan. Go ahead.
I was just going to say. Basically, what happens is, for the first 5 years, they are absolutely in control, and they have to reach these goals of 100% monitoring of the entire border and apprehending 90% of these folks going through these high risk areas. If after 5 years they have not reached those goals, then a border commission is created. And they would take over responsibility for implementing this border security strategy. And the commission would comprise of the four governors of the four border states, and then appointees from both parties in Congress. And so they would be responsible for dictating the plan. They'd get an additional $2 billion to do it. And so they would dictate to the Department of Homeland Security how to use their agents, how to move them around, and how to try to stop these waves of illegal immigration.
About a minute before our first break here, but does anyone know how many people are coming over that border? We learned a couple of years ago when we were deep in the recession that it really slowed to a trickle. Has it picked up? Does anybody know?
I mean, just in the past year, it looks like it has started picking up. You know, somebody once told me that, you know, these unauthorized immigrants who come in make pretty good economists. They know what the labor situation is like. They know what the demand is like. And as we're starting to creep out of this recession, you're starting to see that increasing once again. I mean, we're still at levels that are far, far lower than the worst years during the 90s and 2000s. Back then, we were getting over 1 million people crossing a year, at least. And now we're in the 300,000 range of folks that they think are coming in. But it's definitely, just in the last year or so, it's started to trickle back up as things have started improving over here.
And that's Alan Gomez, immigration reporter for USA Today. We asked him to join us in this first half of Radio Times, first half of the first hour of Radio Times, to help us understand what's in this immigration bill introduced in the Senate last week. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Call us. Stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
AT&T Productions, Philadelphia's all-comedy theater company, supports WHYY. Now on stage, It's My Party, the Women in Comedy Project, a world premiere comedy written and directed by Jennifer Childs. Featuring an eclectic cast of Philadelphia actresses, It's My Party, the Women in Comedy Project dives into the many roles comedy plays in women's lives, exploring and exposing the real comedy of everyday life. Tickets and information at 1812productions.org.
This is it. This is it, the final stretch of WHYY's quiet campaign. We're less than $8,000 from our goal of $25,000 by midnight tonight. If we reach the goal, then Pledge Central will be shut down tomorrow. Let your voice be heard. Join the quiet campaign now. Visit WHYY.org/support to make your gift. It's WHYY.org/support. Thanks. This is Terry Gross. Join me Sunday afternoon, May 5th, at the McCarter Theater in Princeton for Off Air with Fresh Air. I'll talk about my adventures hosting Fresh Air, play clips of interviews in which things didn't exactly go as expected, and then you could give me a taste of my own medicine during the Q&A. There will be more to see than just me. We'll have animations by WHYY's digital artist-in-residence, Tony Off. For information, visit whyy.org/events.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. A quick recap. A bipartisan group of senators who call themselves the Gang of Eight unveiled their long-awaited plan to overhaul the country's immigration system last week. Much of that was overshadowed by the bombings in Boston and the aftermath of those bombings. We asked Alan Gomez, immigration reporter for USA Today, to tell us what's inside this bill. And again, we are taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. And in about 10 minutes, we're going to shift gears and talk about why the expanded background check bipartisan measure was defeated last week in the Senate as well. Alan, let me go back to you and help us understand the E-Verify part of this bill.
So one of the big things that they really, before all the people who are in the country illegally right now can become legal permanent residents or become U.S. citizens, you got to get all this funding down at the border. You have to develop a, what's called an entry-exit system that checks every time an immigrant comes into and out of the country, and then you need E-Verify to be nationwide. Now, basically, that's a program that allows business owners to quickly and online check the immigration status of new hires. Right now, it's being used around the country right now, but this bill would require it to be nationwide within 5 years.
And is it effective? I mean, is it correct? I know there have been some complaints about E-Verify.
I mean, it is about 98-99% effective in identifying and approving people who should be allowed to work. The questions arise when people who are legally allowed to work get flagged by the system as possibly being ineligible to work. There have been a couple of studies looking at this saying if the program were taken nationwide, you would have hundreds of thousands of legal U.S. residents of U.S. citizens being falsely identified by this. So the bill does do a couple of things to try to speed up that process of getting it closer to 100% certainty, but that's definitely one of the concerns about rolling this thing out nationwide.
And for those people, and there are millions of them who are in this country illegally, then what in this bill are the steps to citizenship?
There are several steps. Unauthorized immigrants who were brought to the country when they were children, they're known as dreamers. They would have one of the quickest paths. They can get their green cards within 5 years, apply for citizenship just a couple of years later. Same thing for people who have been working in the agricultural industry. There are estimates that about 50% of the farm labor in this country is done by unauthorized immigrants right now. And if you've been doing that for several years, you will also have that sort of 5 year path to a green card with a quick road to citizenship. Everybody else, what happens is they can very quickly become get a sort of temporary legal status, and they will be able to stay in that for about 10 years, and then they can start filing to get their green card, and then they could eventually become U.S. citizens within 13 years. It's a complicated process. They have to pay back taxes. They have to pay fees of at least $2,000 by the end of it. They have to undergo a criminal background check. They have to learn English. They have to take civics. They have to do quite a few things to reach that point. But yeah, if everything works out, generally a large chunk of these 11 million that are here illegally right now would be able to become citizens within 13 years.
That seems like a long time.
That's definitely one of the concerns from folks who are looking at this bill. They think there's too many hoops that they got to jump through. They think it's too long. And so that's that number of 13, I can tell you, is something that has been debated for months and months here in D.C. as they've tried to strike that proper balance between people who think that they really need to go through a long and arduous process and others who say, hey, you know, what's the point of keeping them in this sort of limbo for so long? Let's move it along quicker.
What about those people who are entering the country illegally? And there have been complaints that that's a long and arduous process as well. Does this bill address that?
The ones who've been entering illegally?
Yeah. The idea of visas and green cards and I guess some of the burdens of getting these legal ways of living and working in the country.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the reasons that a huge chunk of this bill is dedicated to reforming the legal immigration system that we have. Right now, if you look at people wait 10, 20 years to get green cards to get over here, and that's through either trying to get in because you have a relative here or trying to get in because of work. What this bill does is really it shifts the focus of our immigration system to more of an economic-based one. So it grants hundreds of thousands of new visas for people with high-tech skills that work in computer technology, that work in mathematics. It grants a lot of visas for also people at the very low end of the spectrum, mm-hmm. the folks that are going to be working as janitors, as in hospitality and things like that. So it's creating the people who drafted the bill, the way they looked at it is there's 11 million people here unauthorized for a reason. They're working. So what they're trying to do is reform the system so that so we can bring in these workers in a more manageable way without having to resort to this unauthorized labor pool.
Has there been polling about where the public stands on, at least broadly speaking, some kind of path to citizenship?
The polling that's been done over the last few years, it's been fascinating. Even folks who think that the first thing we need to do is secure the border, I've never seen a poll that says that most Americans believe that we should deport the folks who are here illegally right now. As long as it's this combination of securing the border, making it a tough road to citizenship, and making sure, and one of the key things is making sure that they don't jump in line ahead of people who are legally applying to enter the country, then you see pretty broad support for getting something like that through.
We've been focusing on the Senate because they have actually introduced legislation. What happens next in the Senate? And I do want to ask you about the House.
The Senate, they are actually right now they're having another hearing on this bill. Secretary Napolitano, the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, is testifying right now, and they're going to start in the Senate Judiciary Committee in about 2 weeks. They're going to start voting on the bill in that committee. So they'll start changing it, offering up amendments. It's going to be a very complicated, difficult process there.
Well, I'm sorry, no, go ahead.
Yeah, and then I was going to say, the House, they are, like I said, they're in the final phase of drafting their bill. They hope to get it out within the next couple of weeks, with the idea being that maybe the House could pass its own version of a bill, the Senate could pass its own version, and then they meet in a conference committee and work out all the details.
And where does the White House stand on at least broadly speaking, immigration reform?
The White House is absolutely pushing for this. They've crafted their own bill. Sort of as a backup plan, and in their words, in case Congress doesn't act fast enough. So for now, what they're doing is kind of sitting back, letting Congress take the lead on this. But they've said a few times, and the president himself during a speech in Las Vegas in January said that if they don't act fast enough, he's got a bill, he'll present it to Congress and demand a vote. So, you know, they're trying to let the process play out for now, but they're definitely sitting there ready to go if the Congress takes it too much time.
Are you a betting man, Alan Gomez?
Oh, not on someone.
I mean, it's just too soon. We're just too early in the process to know how this and where this is going to end.
It's too early in the process, and beyond that, it's a little bit like what I was talking about earlier. The idea that there are so many different competing factors on every aspect of this bill. I've been covering immigration for a while now, and watching just any individual piece that we see in this bill. There's broad agreement on the fact that we should be giving out more visas to people with high-tech backgrounds, people with masters in computer science and science, technology, engineering, mathematics. But even those kind of bills haven't even made it through one chamber of Congress on their own because of the very different views on each of those issues. So when you bring it all together and into this giant bill and have so many different actors kind of looking at it, there's just so many places where it could stumble. But at the same time, this is the furthest I think that they've gotten in a very, very long time. Everybody's kind of hanging in there for now. So, you know, it's definitely the best shot that it's had in a long, long time.
Well, I appreciate the fact that you joined us today in Radio Times. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And he's Alan Gomez, immigration reporter for USA Today, getting us up to speed on a bipartisan bill introduced in the Senate last week to take a look to, or at least attempt to, overhaul the country's immigration system. Well, last week, the Senate voted 54-46 to reject a bipartisan deal worked out between Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania and Joe Manchin of West Virginia that would have expanded background checks on gun sales. This measure was supported by a huge majority of the American public and a sizable number of gun owners, even members of the NRA. In fact, it was supported by a majority of the senators, and yet it could not overcome a threatened Republican filibuster. President Obama expressed his frustration in the White House Rose Garden.
I've heard some say that blocking this step would be a victory. And my question is, a victory for who? A victory for what? All that happened today was the preservation of the loophole that lets dangerous criminals buy guns without a background check. That didn't make our kids safer. Victory for not doing something that 90% of Americans, 80% of Republicans, the vast majority of your constituents wanted to get done? It begs the question, who are we here to represent? I've heard folks say that having the families of victims lobby for this legislation was somehow misplaced. A prop, somebody called them. Emotional blackmail, some outlets said. Are they serious? Do we really think that thousands of families whose lives have been shattered by gun violence don't have a right to weigh in on this issue? Do we think their emotions, their loss, is not relevant to this debate? So all in all, this was a pretty shameful day for Washington.
Ross Baker joins us now on Radio Times, professor of political science at Rutgers University in New Brunswick, New Jersey. He's also a member of the board of contributors of USA Today. And Ross, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Maury. It's always a pleasure.
And it's interesting that the president talked about a shameful day in Washington. Patricia Mesha was in the gallery when this vote went down last week, shouted to the members of the Senate, shame on you. Were you surprised that this bill was essentially defeated?
No, I wasn't. I understand, the president's moral indignation. It's something he cared very deeply about, and I think that his emotions were genuine. The problem was, I think, that the proponents of the bill, even though they had this very impressive data on public opinion, I think really never made the case satisfactorily that in any of the particularly outrageous gun crimes that were committed, Aurora and Newtown and Columbine and so on, that in any of those cases, the expanded background checks would have caught the perpetrators. And that's one argument that the opponents had that I think was very difficult to refute. The senators who come from the less populous, more hunting-oriented states, more gun-oriented states, were not going to support it. Great disappointment to the president, of course, were the Democrats who voted against it, but they are Democrats who come from those kinds of places.
Well, it's interesting and frankly tragic that you've got families of the victims in Newtown. They were apparently, roaming the hallways of Congress to try to get support for this bill. Obviously, very emotional message that they had to convey there, that somehow didn't resonate.
I think it resonated, but I think it clashed with the political realities for a lot of members of Congress who, quite frankly, want to get reelected. Honestly, Marty, we think of this as being a much less important value than protecting children and from gun crimes and so on. But from the point of view of members of Congress, it's getting reelected is paramount. And that prevailed. And let me just add one more thing, and that is that there's a belief that somehow we can translate public opinion into public policy, that when you're able to demonstrate based on polls that 80-90% of the people support something, it seems axiomatic that you should be able to get members of Congress to respond to this and to act accordingly. The problem is that in one of the, I guess, the real political science 101 axioms is that intensity trumps preference.
And intensity coming from organizations like the NRA, for instance?
That's right. For NRA members or for people who are, you know, gun collectors and shooters and so on, this is a voting issue. One of the things that members of Congress know is that gun owners, members of the National Rifle Association, are very much like members of the Right to Life community in the United States. That is, they care deeply. They will protest, they will demonstrate, and ultimately they will vote. Whereas people on the other side of the issue tend to hold these opinions, although sincerely, but much more casually and with much less intensity, and think about other things in addition to things like guns or abortion.
Let me quote something that Gabrielle Giffords wrote in the New York Times last week, and this is about this defeat of this bill. She says, these senators, obviously the ones who voted to defeat it, made their decision based on political fear and on cold calculations about the money of special interests like the National Rifle Association, which in the last election cycle spent about $25 million on contributions, lobbying, and outside spending. I mean, do you think it is it's cold cash and fear that was part of what was so influential in that vote last week?
Marty, I go with the fear factor, really? But I discount the cash factor. I think that these members who voted against it would have voted against it if the NRA didn't give them a dime. This is about votes. It's not about campaign contributions. The money that the NRA gives, while considerable, could easily be replaced by other sources of contributions. People who represent interest groups are only too happy to line up to give money to the campaigns of incumbent members of Congress. What I think the members who vote and senators who voted against it were really concerned about was Election Day.
And I guess there were four Democrats who voted against this proposal, and the president has been criticized for not doing enough to bring them over to his side. Do you think he failed on that front?
Well, I read Maureen Dowd's column in the New York Times on Sunday with great interest because she savaged the president.
She did.
For basically not twisting arms. And, you know, it's interesting because, the most respected treatise on the presidency, Richard Neustadt's Presidential Power, talks about the power of the president being the power to persuade. And the president is very good at kind of soft persuasion, the dinners at the White House or in Washington hotels and so on. I mean, the president, you know, is a likable and an intelligent man. The problem, you know, I think for him is closing the deal. And closing the deal sometimes requires a degree of toughness, even ruthlessness, I think that the president just doesn't have.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We called Ross Baker to join us. Once again, we do this from time to time when we have to talk about politics and policies. And he's a professor of political science at Rutgers University at their New Brunswick, New Jersey campus. Also a member of the board of contributors of USA Today. And we're talking about the vote last week, essentially to defeat the expanded background check measure on gun sales. And talking about why it was defeated, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Widener supports WHYY. A graduate degree from Widener University is designed to help be the difference in your career. Widener University offers graduate degrees in programs including public administration, liberal studies, and more. Registration at widener.edu/graduate.
Of the next fresh air, Matthew McConaughey. He's starring in the new film Mud, recently starred in Magic Mike, Killer Joe, and Bernie, and co-stars in Martin Scorsese's next film. He'll talk with us about his life and movies and why he often does this. Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. The Boston investigation continues, but how do you try someone when everyone has watched events unfold on TV? Also, a tree farmer from Michigan trying to grow the population of California redwoods by cloning them and planting them in tree archives around the world. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
The Chester County Hospital supports WHYY and reminds women 40 years of age and older of the importance of annual mammograms. To schedule a mammogram at the Chester County Hospital's nationally accredited breast center, 610-431-5131.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Ross Baker about why this Senate defeated a bipartisan measure last week that would have expanded background checks on gun sales, supported by a huge majority of the public. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Ross, I want to quote Robert Dalek, who's quoted in the New York Times today, talking about what you were talking about right before the break, and the Times says Robert Dalek, a historian biographer of President Lyndon Johnson, said Mr. Obama seems inclined to believe that sweet reason is what you need to use with people in high office, and that contrasts with Johnson's belief that what you need to do is back people up against the wall. Do you think there's some truth to that?
I do. Yeah, I think that that President Obama, you know, sometimes reverts to his earlier persona of being a professor of constitutional law, in which a closely reasoned argument usually wins the day. That just isn't the case with politicians who have very practical concerns, and it may be that the president has to present to these people, like Senator Begich from Alaska or Senator Heitkamp from North Dakota, an ugly alternative. Mm-hmm. The president does have these preferments that he can use to help people or to hurt them in terms of getting federal projects and so on. I mean, even with the elimination of earmarks, the president really does have these powers and can make life miserable for a member of Congress.
So back them up against the wall and say, essentially, if you don't vote for this, we're not going to support you. We're going to, you know, pull out support for your prized projects.
I think that's right. I think that's right. And I think that, you know, it may be that being persecuted by the president can be a political advantage in places like North Dakota.
Right.
So Senator Heitkamp might well have said, you know, go have at it, Mr. President.
Right. But Maureen Dowd raised this, whether members of Congress or even members of the Senate, whether they fear Obama and whether that's an important way of getting legislation through, which is through the fear factor, to use your words.
Right. Well, I mean, I can only invoke the immortal words of Machiavelli.
Yeah, there you go.
And that is, you know, it is better to be feared than loved. And very few members of Congress can be moved out of pure positive sentiment rather than sheer blood-chilling fear.
But do you think that's new? Or I mean, do you think it's that President Obama doesn't have the kind of psychology or even constitution to use fear, or that Congress is so changed and so partisan now that it wouldn't work anyway?
I think the latter is the case. I mean, I think that there are not many things that the president can do to really convert people from positions that they've long held. Because one of the things that lobbyists will tell you is that basically they do their work on the persuadables. So, you know, there's a certain number of members of the Senate who could be persuaded, for example, to oppose the filibustering of the initial motion to proceed, and basically blocking the filibuster to block the debate. And you had a number of Republicans who said, no, it's not a good idea to block the debate. Let's go ahead and have it. But at the same time, they said, don't count on me to vote to support the Manchin-Toomey amendment on final passage.
Mm.
So, I mean, a senator from a state that is strongly pro-gun is not going to be easily coerced, even by a particularly muscular president.
But here, this gets to the fact that a majority, not a filibuster-proof majority, but a majority of the senators, 54 of them, did at least vote on this, or vote on the vote to vote.
Right.
I think I said that right. And that's a majority of the Senate. Why does everything have to be threatened with a filibuster?
Well, you know, the 60-vote threshold for anything that's important is usually a result of negotiations between Senator Reid and Senator McConnell. There's a lot of things that pass the Senate by unanimous consent, but they're relatively consensual issues. On anything that's contested, there's an assumption that it will have to get 60 votes. And of course, this is the legendary filibuster. And in order to quash a filibuster, you're going to need 60 votes. And in a Senate as closely divided as the United States Senate is now, that's a hard thing to do. Even with 55 Democrats, getting the five Republicans who might conceivably vote to shut down a filibuster is difficult.
Does this also explain why the public holds Congress in such low regard?
Oh, it does. There's no question about it. I mean, I think that one of the things that Congress was rarely susceptible to was being stampeded by public opinion.
Yeah.
These senators and House members are only too acutely aware of what's in the minds of their constituents. And if public opinion is overwhelmingly nationally in favor of something, and their constituency of 700,000 Americans has the opposite opinion, they're going to go with a smaller group.
And that would describe some of the districts in this country.
That is correct.
And does that go back to, does everything lead back to gerrymandering?
No. Well, I mean, to some extent it does. It's interesting, that the Republicans enjoy a kind of structural advantage in terms of the House of Representatives, which only partly explained by the gerrymander. And what it is this, that if you use the letter D as a surrogate for the Democrats, their populations are densely packed into urban areas. The Republicans, the R stands for rural, and so they have an enormous advantage in these rural districts, and there are enough of them that could certainly block the passage of legislation in the House. And the senators, of course, many of who come from very low population states, the Montana senators, the Wyoming senators, the Idaho senators, have the same vote as Senator Schumer from New York or Senator Boxer from California.
So the senators from less populous states are calling the shots?
To a very great extent, that's the case. But, you know, that's not out of line with what James Madison had in mind when they were putting together the Constitution, was the protection of minority rights.
And that's Ross Baker, Rutgers University political scientist, who did predict the gun vote would fail in the Senate last week, which it did. We're talking about the politics, I guess, and the policies as well. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Ross, it's interesting that this bill was written by Joe Manchin, a Democrat from a red state, and Pat Toomey, a Republican from a blue state. I got that right.
Mm-hmm.
So representing an interesting mix of politics, that they were at least able to come together on this particular bill, or actually write this particular bill.
They were. And I think that in the case of Senator Manchin, he's a very unusual man. I don't think anyone reacted in so heartfelt and emotional a way to what happened at Newtown as he did. He is somebody who visualizes the faces of those children and sees his own grandchildren. I mean, this is very clear. I know less about Senator Toomey, but, I mean, clearly he took a big risk as well, but not so big a risk as you might imagine. I think that there's a political calculation there, which is that he's a very conservative Republican in a state that clearly is not homogeneously conservative. It's a state that Democratic presidential candidates routinely carry. And I think it was, on his part, a very astute move to kind of moderate his image in the eyes of Pennsylvania voters. But I think in both cases, it required a good deal of courage to do that and to run the risk, of course, of being, you know, being the target of a lot of kind of aggressive behavior and nasty comments by pro-gun people.
I thought it was interesting that Senator Manchin essentially accused the NRA of lying, saying that this legislation would create some kind of a gun registry. And my reading of the legislation is it did exactly the opposite.
It specifically forbade it, in fact, made it a federal crime to use the statistics collected as the result of background checks to create a national registry. But, you know, the National Rifle Association is really quite an ingenious organization. They are the masters of the slippery slope argument, and that is that almost any effort in terms of background checks, certainly, and even more so in the case of firearms themselves, is ultimately going to lead to confiscation.
And
they can trace that downward slope with enormous eloquence.
You mentioned earmarks, and it's near impossible, I guess, to do earmarks these days. I mean, what kind of goodies does either Senator Reid or any of the leadership in Congress or the president have to win over someone when it comes to a piece of legislation?
Well, having spent
and dining didn't seem to do such a great job.
No, having spent 6 months, most recently in Senator Reid's office, I can tell you, the emoluments are few. I mean, it has to do with committee assignments. It may have to do with Senator Reid might be able to give somebody a hideaway office with a window.
Really? Is that what we're talking about?
A window.
As opposed to a bridge to nowhere or somewhere?
Yeah, there aren't many bridges to nowhere, but, you know, it's interesting. There are things that can be done. For example, things like tariff provisions are very often an interesting substitute for earmarks, giving tariff preferences to certain industries and so on. There are ways around it, and I think, actually, Senator Reid pretty much pulled out all the stops that he had, but he just ran up against the political realities that some of these senators saw for themselves in supporting the background checks legislation.
Senator Reid said we're going to take a pause and the fight is just beginning. I mean, are those just sort of words to sort of mollify everybody, or do you think this issue will come back and then we'll get to our callers?
Well, I think Senator Reid, by voting against Toomey Manchin, of course, that's a procedural move, reserved the right to reintroduce it.
Right. And just so our listeners understand, because when I read that, I thought maybe I misread it. So he voted against a bill that he at least said he supported, but he did that in order to bring it back?
That's right. Only an opponent of the legislation has the ability to do that.
All right.
It's a peculiarity of the arcane rules of the United States Senate.
Indeed it is. So do you think, do you anticipate in this session or this year that this will come back, or do you think there are other things that are going to be taking up the Senate's time?
Well, you know, I didn't hear all of Alan Gomez's conversation with you, but I'm fairly pessimistic about the chances for comprehensive immigration reform for many of the same reasons.
Just that there's too much disagreement, it's too complicated, it's too loaded, it's too political?
Yes, I mean, it's really amazing because yesterday, actually, NPR had a very interesting piece on the kind of payoffs that were given to senators in the 844-page bill, including to Senator Bennett from Colorado, visas for foreign ski instructors. I mean, it's that kind of thing that pulls legislation down.
I wish you could see my engineer here. He just threw up his hands. Let me get Ted. I feel his pain, actually. Let me get Ted from Pottstown to join us. Ted, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
I just wanted to ask, you've been talking a little bit about special interests, and I wanted to ask why you or the caller think that, or if you think, that it's the Senate defending special interests at the expense of principle, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Don't leave his head. I mean, the principle of what?
The right to bear arms.
So you're, I don't exactly understand what you're saying. Just try it again. I'm sorry.
Will the Senate be defending, or has the Senate defended the right to bear arms, even at the expense of temporary public perception? Ultimately, in defense of the public?
I'm not sure I understand, but let me see if Ross Baker does.
Well, if what Ted is saying is that the United States Senate showed courage by standing up to public opinion, I think, you know, certainly if you are a, you know, believer in the purest, you know, expression of the Second Amendment, very much so. You know, you can say that, you know, with all the emotional artillery that the president unleashed with the Newtown families and so on, for the Senate to have turned down the Toomey Mansion amendment, I suppose, you know, shows a great deal of willingness to withstand the winds of public opinion.
Ted, I think Ross Baker actually understood what you were calling about, and I appreciate the phone call to Radio Times. So, does the public opinion doesn't matter, or it just matters in ways that we might not understand?
It matters in a kind of metaphysical way that I, as a political scientist, always find difficult to explain.
Yes.
Certainly, if you've got public opinion behind you, it allows you to make a much more forcible argument. But it doesn't clinch the deal, particularly because there's a kind of circuit breaker there. And it has to do with interest groups who certainly can be very persuasive in pointing out the other side of the argument, and particularly in pointing out to members of Congress the costs that would be incurred in supporting something that their constituents don't support.
So get organized. I mean, it sounds like if you care about an issue, then be organized and be vocal.
That's right, and be passionate, and vote on that basis. Yes.
Well, Ross Baker, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
It was great to be with you again, Marty.
A little lesson for us all, and that's Ross Baker, professor of political science at Rutgers University at their New Brunswick, New Jersey campus, and joined us on Radio Times to talk about why the gun background check bill was defeated last week. And we began our conversation with Alan Gomez, immigration reporter for USA Today, talking about what's inside the immigration bill that was introduced last week. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including Facebook and Twitter, email, archives, podcasts, Sirius Satellite Radio. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour. Stay with us. We'll be right back.